is February 6th, and it's the first of our, sadly, only three sessions to focus on the book of Job. let me begin by sharing with you a news story from a few weeks ago that you may have been aware of or you may not have been aware of. A plane crashed in Costa Rica. And this plane included among its only a dozen passengers a family of five and a family of four, all of whom happened to be Jewish. The family of five, very prominent in their Reform congregation, very active, philanthropic, contributing time and resources to Seeds for Peace and other endeavors attempting to bring Jews and Arabs together in the land of Israel. The family of four, very active in their conservative congregation, including their daughter, who was very active in USY, and who was, in her shul, was the vice president for Tikkun Olam. We all know what Tikkun Olam is, right? It's doing good deeds for the world. Had attended Ramah Darom, the southern Camp Ramah in Georgia. Was an intern in college for USY, as well as for Chazon, which is a Jewish organization devoted to creating a healthier and more sustainable Jewish community. And she was, at the time of her death, a student at Columbia University and the Jewish Theological Seminary, as is one of our young people in our congregation, Shira Fardman. This event, which we tend to describe, we have a word we use in English to describe an event like this, which is an accident. We call it an accident, right? We say an accident occurred. And this accident, in fact, resulted in these lives being lost, among others. But it's an interesting event because it is one of many, many events that we could point to. And I'm sure all of us, thinking about our own lives, can think about events in our own lives in which the question comes to our consciousness, which is why? Why did this happen? Now, when we ask that question, why, we are seeking an explanation. But the kind of an explanation that we seek when we ask the question, why, is more than, quote, the pilot lost control of the plane, or a screw that had been insufficiently attached to the fuselage broke through and the navigator controls were lost. We are seeking more than those kinds of explanations which, in fact, render the world predictable but not necessarily meaningful. When we ask the question why, or when we are tempted to ask the question why, and that's a collective we, by the way. It's not we in this room. It's humankind or humanity over the ages and in various societies and various cultures. When we ask that question, we seek meaning. In fact, you could argue that what distinguishes us from the other creatures on this planet is that we are meaning makers. We seek meaning. By the way, what's going around is our name tags, which Wendy has now, and I encourage you to put your name on, and also a sheet with, which is an attendance sheet, is very, very helpful, and that's going around. So we are meaning makers, constantly seeking to understand our world in terms of what is commonly called cause and effect. Now, that's the term we use that we overlay as if it's a transparency, often, over two events that are distinguished by being close to one another in time and maybe in location. We look at these two events, or we look at one event and we seek another event, and we say, aha, the connection between these two events is described by a Latin phrase. Of course. And the Latin phrase is post hoc ergo propter hoc, which means, well, this is after something, and therefore it's because of that something. In other words, we seek cause and effect where there may not necessarily inherently be cause and effect. Now, by the way, not only would you say that, some would say that what distinguishes us is that we are meaning makers, but one Christian theologian who's quoted by Harold Kushner in his book on Job, which I'll get to in a moment, is that what makes us unique is that we can find meaning in suffering. We can find meaning in suffering, or we seek meaning in suffering, whether we find it or not. Now, why do we do that? Why do we seek meaning? Well, Harold Kushner suggests that the reason that we seek meaning, and this is an old Jewish notion as well, is that misfortune becomes less painful and more bearable if we can either discern a meaning or impose a meaning. Now, discerning a meaning is saying, ah, so that's why it happened. That's discerning a connection. That's a meaning. Imposing a meaning can be attributing meaning where it isn't necessarily there, or it could be saying, and this human beings can do, what can I do to make something good come out of this? That's another example of imposing meaning. It's allowing ourselves to take what is and to change what is. By the way, this kind of thinking, this post hoc ergo propter hoc thinking, it leads people, when going through life, to alter their behavior consistent with that connection to try to influence the future. I'll give you a good example, and this probably will be familiar to some of us, okay? You're watching a football game, but in the middle of the game, you realize you need to go to the bathroom. You get up and you go to the bathroom. By the time you come back, the opposing team has scored a touchdown. So what do? The next time you watch your team play, you don't go to the bathroom. Because that may lead to the same result that it led to the first time. Now, that is what we commonly would call a superstition. But in fact, superstitions are more widely known than we think. And I'll give you another example of that. And this is a wonderful story, which also Harold Kushner quotes. He tells this story about a congregant of his whose daughter went into labor early and delivered a premature baby. And so the baby did come home, but was really, really tiny in her crib. And so this gentleman was telling Rabbi Kushner that his son-in-law's mother, in other words, his machateniste, is what we would describe it in Yiddish, said that they really should put an amulet in the crib because the baby was premature and it would offer some protection for her. So when Rabbi Kushner heard the story, he said to the man, did you put the amulet in? And the man was actually a little indignant. He said, of course not. We're not superstitious. Instead, we put a Bible in the crib. Okay. So they didn't put the amulet in. They put the Bible in the crib. Okay. Now, that kind of leads us to ask the question, well, why do religious people behave this way? why do we see this kind of thinking and behaving among religious people? And the answer is that in our sacred texts, and I speak now of Jewish sacred texts, but it's true of many different religions, of course, we reinforce that kind of thinking. And I can give you many, many examples. A very typical and a significant example is in the second paragraph of the Shema. We say the Shema twice a day. It consists of three paragraphs. And in the second or middle paragraph are the following words. If you will diligently obey my commandments, I will give rain for your land at the proper time. Okay, so that's basically saying that when rain comes, we're to think back and say, well, we were consistently faithful and diligent. And by the way, the text goes on to say, take care lest your heart be lured away, because then the Lord's wrath will flare up against you and he'll close up the heavens and there'll be no rain. So the next time there's no rain, we say God is displeased with us. Not only is God displeased with us, God is displeased with us for good reason, because we were lured away. Okay. There are many, many other examples, and I'll just give you one right now. This is chapter 37 of the book of Psalms. Okay, chapter 37 of the book of Psalms. Leave everything to God. Trust in him. He will do it. He will vindicate you like the light. He'll vindicate the justice of your case like the noonday sun. Be patient and wait for God. Don't be vexed by the prospering man who carries out his schemes. In other words, don't be deceived by events that seem counter to this narrative. Listen, evil people will eventually be cut off, but those who look to the Lord shall inherit the land. A little longer and there won't be a wicked man. Look at where he was, he'll be gone. Rather, the lowly shall inherit the land and delight in abundant well-being. The wicked man schemes against the righteous and gnashes his teeth at him. The Lord laughs at him, for he knows his day will come. So the message of the psalm, like the message of the second paragraph of the Shema, like the messages of many passages, is what? If you had to sum it up, what would you say? How would you sum up this message, the message of these texts? What would you say? I mean, I could give it 3-4 words. What would you say?
Wait, something good will come along.
Wait, something good will come along always? Or?
Always.
Always? Even if you're an evil SOB?
Mm-hmm. No, righteous.
No, only if you're righteous. So there's an if-then, right? If you're righteous, things will go fine, eventually.
It doesn't always work, though.
Now, that's not what the text says, right? The text says, don't be vexed, right? Don't be vexed. In other words, wait. Sort of comes back to what you were saying earlier. In other words, the fact that we might experience an inconsistency between this theology and life on this planet is considered to be something that can be addressed with what? Have faith. Time. Okay? Whatever the case might be. Okay. I think this catches the idea. By the way, there's one more point, and that is, why do we so want to believe that good things happen to good people and bad things happen to bad people? Why do we want to believe that? Is there a reason? Is there something within us that wants that? Why? What would it be? Yeah?
Well, we like to live in an orderly universe.
We love to live in an orderly universe, and I agree. I think that's it. But what kind of an orderly universe? It's a just. And what other words come to mind when you hear about good things happening to good people and bad things happening to bad things? It's not just, but it's fair. That's I think, a very nice word, that word fair, because we all know what it's like to be on the playground and someone is not playing right, that's not fair. And that cuts to us very, very... It's not fair. So I want to use the word fair instead of just because it feels more personal. Like, a kid doesn't come up to his mom and say, Jimmy's being unjust to me. No, he's being unfair to me. Fairness gets at the core of who we are. Okay. So, by the way, let's push what Ted added at the end of his, you know, eloquent description of the theology. He said, yeah, but it doesn't always work out that way. So what happens when things don't work out the way we expect them to? And we don't have the patience to say, well, eventually it will, things will be fine. What that can do to us is, it, first of all, it can tear us up, right? And it can also lead us to throw the Tanakh, to throw the Bible in with the amulet and throw them both out in the trash, right? Because what we expected to be the case isn't the case, okay? And, you know, after all, if good deeds don't lead to good outcomes, why bother to be good? Why bother to learn how to be good? What's going on? It doesn't satisfy me inside. I'm empty inside. There's a lack of coherence in the world. So there are texts that don't seem to even admit of this problem, such as this Psalm 37, which is a lovely psalm, by the way. And then there are texts, few but important texts, that grab that problem by the tail or by the legs and shake it. And one such text is the book of Job. Now, the book of Job is a book that is rarely taught in shul. Not only is it rarely taught in shul, it's rarely taught in church. And it's a book I've wanted to talk about and to share and to teach for a long time. And I'll tell you why. Because I once... I was introduced to the importance of the book of Job by a mentor of mine. Many years ago, I taught high school at the Commonwealth School in Boston. And the headmaster at the time was Charles Merrill, the son of the Merrill of the Merrill Lynch banking firm. And, you know, he was a very inspiring figure. And he did a number of very unusual things at this private high school that was rather secular in its ostensible state of mind. Every year he taught a class to the ninth graders and the 10th graders. He taught them Bible 9 and Bible 10. And then by the time they were in 11th grade, they changed the title to philosophy because he said the kids will not think that it's the same thing, he said. I'm teaching the same thing. Same books, but we call it philosophy. And we talked about what it means for kids to encounter the Bible and what stories resonate, what texts resonate, which ones don't. And he once said to me that... he said, the book of Job is a book that is not taught enough and should be taught more, and people are hesitant to teach it because it is so, it challenges so much of our thinking and what we take for granted and what we'd like to believe. And he said, most clergymen, at the time he said most clergymen, I'm quoting him, are afraid to teach the book of Job. At the time, I wasn't a rabbi, but I thought, I remembered that line. I said to myself, you know, if I ever become a rabbi, I don't want to be afraid to teach the book of Job. So 27 years later, I'm getting around to teaching the book of Job explicitly. And it's not just coincidental, but Charles Merrill passed away about a month or so ago. And at the age of 97. And I went to a memorial service in his memory. And I was reminded of just how significant the book was in terms of his own way of coming, of understanding the world, and how much we can all learn from it. So consider that to be an introduction to why I really would like to teach this book, and we'll take a stab at it. Now, there are 42 chapters of the book of Job. Were we to meet every Tuesday night for a year, we could barely touch the surface of this book. Why? It's a very difficult book for a number of reasons. One of them being the words themselves. The words themselves are very hard. I think the largest number of words that have no other pair in the entire Bible are in the book of Job. It's called in Greek a hapax legomenon. That's a word that has no other pair. And in Hebrew you say it's a word that doesn't have a companion. So they're unusual words. There are some unusual passages. The book shows signs of editing. It's not so clear. So it's not easy to read in Hebrew. In fact, they say that there's a book of the Bible. I think they're referring to the book of Proverbs. There's the book of, let me get this straight. There's the book of Kohelet, there's the book of Proverbs, and there's the book of Job. These are all wisdom books. And in one, they say one chapter doesn't necessarily connect with the next chapter. And another one verse doesn't connect with the next verse. And in the book of Job, sometimes one word doesn't connect with the next word. But nonetheless, it's an important book. And I think our purpose in this particular class is to try to wrestle with the attempt of the book of Job to make meaning. Okay? So let me tell you how we're going to do this. The book of Job consists of 42 chapters. However, scholars believe that the book is really composed of several layers. One layer is an envelope for the entire book. It's the first two chapters, and it's about 10 verses at the very, very end. And that is a remnant of an ancient fable called the Fable of Job. Within that envelope of chapters 1 and 2, and the very, very last few verses of the 42nd chapter, is a lengthy poetic work called the Poem of Job. Very, very different in tone, very, very unusual, not often appreciated in its complexity and in its force. That we're going to spend a lot of time on. We're not going to spend 42 times as long as on the envelope, but tonight what we're going to look at is the simple, pious envelope of the first two chapters and the last 10 verses. And then we're going to try to see what is it that should help. How can we read the part in between, both independently and then also interdependently, to make meaning out of it? Okay? All right. Now, I have made a photocopy of the Fable of Job. And you may have a Tanakh with you, and that's perfectly fine. But if you want to follow along on these particular sheets, you're welcome to do that. Let's pass these along. Here we go. So we're going to look at this envelope. And we need to read the envelope first, I think, because it is, if you think about it, it is situated in the Bible. And so the envelope fits in with the rest of the Bible. And it's the interior part that is the challenging part. Now, I think we have enough of these sheets, but I might have distributed too many in one section. So if you don't mind, who does not yet have? They're going around? Okay. Okay. By the way, thank you. You see, you cast your bread upon the waters, and you get them back. Okay. Everybody have who wants. Okay. All right, before we take a look at the Fable of Job, any questions on the introduction that I've given so far? Any questions about this? By the way, how many people here, this is a great question, how many people here, before taking this class, had heard of Job? Okay, good. And how many people here had read the book of Job? I'm really impressed. I'm very impressed. Okay? You know, let me then, before we study this envelope, let me ask you, those who have read it, maybe not even those who have read it, because actually, as we know, a work can have a life and a culture, even among people who haven't read it, you know, sum up the book of Job in a few sentences. Literally a few. Two or three. What would you say? Sum it up.
Life stand out good for him.
Okay.
He was tested by a series of trials.
Mm-hmm.
They made life not good for him.
Yep.
And at the very end, at the envelope at the end, things were even better for him than when he started.
Oh, okay. Did you hear that summary? Did everybody hear it?
No.
No, okay. Things started out okay for Job, then they weren't so good, and in the end, they were even better than they were at the beginning. End of book. Okay. That's one way to sum up the story. Anybody else? Yes.
My takeaway is when Job asks the question, why?
Why? Okay.
And God says, where were you when I created?
Okay.
Like,
so,
is the unknowable, like, don't even ask.
Right. So Susan, in thinking about summing up the book of Job, says, I have this picture of Job saying, why? And God's saying, you know, where were you when I was creating the world? I didn't hear that in that summary. So does that mean
it's... Your fourth sentence.
What? I gave you... Yes, it's a few short sentences. But there's another reason why you didn't hear it. Because in essence, David has summed up the envelope. And by the way, and the defense attorney, prosecuting attorney will tell you this, that when presenting a story to the jury, of course, it's the first thing you say and the last thing you say that really sticks in. And yet, what Susan is saying is, wait a second, what about all that stuff in the middle? You know, there are 39 and a half chapters or something like that. What does all that say? We're going to see, I think we'll certainly see by next week, why that is not, it doesn't come as quickly to mind. It's a little bit challenging. After all, how many people, you know, read poetry every day? How many people read prose every day? We all read prose every day. We don't all read poetry every day. It's hard to read poetry. Poetry is difficult. It's challenging. The first and the last chunks of Job are prose. All the stuff in the middle is poetry. So it's hard. It's hard. It's challenging. It's also challenging in other ways. First of all, it's full of questions. Like, why? Okay? And it's got a few answers that are really not very satisfying. And then other answers that are not satisfying. And then you turn the page, and there are some more answers that are not satisfying. And then some more, why? And then some more answers that are not satisfying until we get to the climax. We're going to talk about that. Okay. Is it clear? Any questions? Okay. So now let's look at this envelope. It's a very simple, you could argue, a simple story. By the way, that's the name of a novel by Shmuel Yosef Agnon, A Simple Story. What do you know about that book? It's anything but simple. Okay, but let's take a look at the simple story of the book of Job. Want to read the first verse? Could somebody read it out loud in Hebrew or in English? You get something more out of it in the Hebrew, but you can get a lot out of it in English as well. Who would like to read that? First verse, just the first verse. Please, Wendy.
There was a man in the land of Uz named Job.
That first of all, I want to say I'm glad she said Uz, because it's not Uz, okay? It's not Oz. This is not the land of Oz, okay? It's the land of Uz, named Job. By the way, it's not, you know, many people, when they name their children, they open up a Bible and they look for a name that has some biblical. I have never known any other child named Eov, as it is in Hebrew. And by the way, when you read the commentaries on this, and you know, there are many, many classic Jewish commentaries on the book of Job. When you are introduced to the character of Job, a common refrain in the commentaries of, you know, of the medievalists is Lo haya v'lo nivra. You know, this is not a real person who existed, but this is a mashal, this is a fable of some kind. So in other words, even the rabbis who read the text very, very seriously and who accepted this as holy writ said, this may not be talking about a real person, Job, but it's a personality. Eov. Okay, and what can you tell us about him, Wendy?
That man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil.
Right. Now, so therefore, on a list of qualities, you know, I mean, if you remember, there was a show when I was a kid called Queen for a Day, you know, and, you know, there was some kind of an applause meter, I think, or something.
And clap-o-meter.
What was it? The clap-o-meter. Is that what it was called? So, you know, if we were to have, you know, forget about Mrs. Job, we'll get to her in a minute, but if Job were here and we had the clap-o-meter, clearly he would bring it all the way to the right side. And the language used, I do just want to introduce you to a little bit of the Hebrew here, because much of the Hebrew is inscrutable, but not this. Hu haya ha'isha hu tam v'yashav. By the way, that word tam might be familiar to you, because, you know, there are four children on Pesach, and one of them is Tam, right? And what's Tam connote? Pure. He's pure. He's pure of heart, right? The Ashar, upright. Yireh Elohim. He's a God-fearer in the way that anyone in the world, not necessarily Jews, can be God-fearers. Who are the famous God-fearers in the book of Exodus? The midwives, who were, we don't know, Egyptian women, probably. They could also have been Hebrew women. They were the women who brought the Hebrew babies into the world. They were God-fearers. And that's a beautiful thing to say about someone, right? We can understand what that connotes in English as well as in Hebrew. They were God-fearing. And then it says, V'sar me'ra. And he shunned evil. Now, sar me'ra is a very interesting phrase. It is a quote. Does anybody know what psalm it's a quote from? It is a Psalm 34. Now, why do I know this so well? I know this so well because when I was a teenager, I was in a chorus in my shul, and I think it was the cantor, but it might have been one of the older kids who wrote a folk rock setting to these verses from the book of Psalms, which is, it begins with Psalm 34, verse 13. Mi ha'ish hechafetz chayim ohev yamim lirotov. Who is the one who is eager for life, who desires years of good fortune? Guard your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking guile. Sur me'ra ba'aseh tov ba'keh shalom v'rofehu. Shun evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it. So, shunning evil, sur me'ra, is a key word there. By the way, that older kid that I mentioned who might have had a hand in either writing the melody or the lyrics was Gil Brodsky. He was 2 years before me in USY. And I have a record, literally a record, you know, an old-fashioned record, of us singing this, okay? Singing this, sur me'ra ba'aseh tov. I remember the melody. I think he wrote the melody or he wrote the lyrics. I'm not sure. In any event, I mean, adapted the lyrics. So, I think we can see Job was a... What's the purpose of telling us that this is true of Job? This is not someone like you or me who might make some mistakes. This is someone who doesn't make mistakes. Okay? This is someone who is, you could say, perfect. Even though we don't use that word with respect to, you know, human beings generally. Okay. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters. It's obviously typological. 7 is a nice number. 3 is a nice number. They signify completion. 7 signifies completion. We have the 7 days of the week, 7 years of the sabbatical cycle, etc., etc. So he had a wonderful family. 7 sons, 3 daughters. His possessions, how many thousand sheep? 7,000 sheep. How many camels? 3,000. You get those numbers. They keep coming back. Of course, 500 yoke of oxen and 500 she-asses, which together add up to 1,000, another wonderful number. And a very, as if we need to be told, a very large household. Okay. He was wealthier than anyone in the East. Then we're told something very, very interesting about him. Look in verse 4. It was the custom of his sons to hold feasts, each on his set day in his own home. In other words, the mishpocha would gather in the different people's homes on different days, right? Son number 1 would host you on Monday, son number 2 on Tuesday. Okay, this was a mishpocha. They got together a lot, right? They would invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. Why aren't the sisters hosting? It's a, you know, let's face it, it's a patriarchal society. You know, the men are the ones doing the hosting, the women are the ones cooking the food. Okay.
I have seven sons.
What was that?
I have seven sons, enough for each day.
That's right. That's right. You have seven sons, one for each day. Very good. And there are only 7 days in the week. So therefore, what can you do? When a round of feast days was over, this is interesting. What do you make of this? Job would send word to them to sanctify themselves, and rising early in the morning, he would make burnt offerings, one for each of them. He'd make a burnt offering. He'd bring an offering to, like, a temple, okay? Clearly, this is not a Jewish story, because otherwise he'd be going to Jerusalem, or he'd be going to Shul. Not that. But he brings a burnt offering. Why? Maybe my children have sinned and blasphemed God in their thoughts. This is what Job always used to do. What's going on there? Why is he bringing these offerings? Prophylactically, you could say. What's this all about? Why is he doing it?
He wants to make sure.
He wants to make sure what?
He wants to make sure that nothing's going to happen
that
to his
nothing's
children.
Going to happen to the sons. And why? Because they're human. Maybe they're not quite like he. You know, Nebuch, in the next generation, kids will be kids. Maybe they're not behaving properly. I'll bring an offering for each one of them. That will protect them. Right? Isn't that the implication here? That will protect them. Okay? One day, the divine beings... Ooh, I thought we were monotheists. I guess not. So we have these divine beings up there. Okay? And the divine beings presented themselves before God, and the adversary came along with them. Now, the Hebrew term for the adversary is Hasatan, which we would ordinarily translate as Satan. The problem with using the term Satan is that we might have an image of a red creature with a fork, you know, saber and horns and smoke coming out of his mouth. That is not the image of Hasatan here. The image simply comes out of this story. So don't have any of those, you know, ideas in your head. He's somehow, literally, an adversary to God somehow, okay? Let's see how he behaves as an adversary. The Lord says to the adversary, I love this, where have you been? Where have you been? The adversary, this is actually, by the way, it's a nice, polite thing to do when someone comes to your house. How are you? Where have you been? Where have you been? Okay. So what does he say? I've been roaming all over the earth. Okay. Presumably he's like a special character. He can go, when he says all over the earth, he means all over the earth, not just here, there, and everywhere. He's been everywhere. So then God says to him, have you noticed my servant Job? And now we have the famous line, Wendy, why don't you read this?
Okay. There is no one like him on earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and shuns evil.
Yeah, Wendy's very useful here. The second time we have the same notion. He's a special person. So the adversary responds to God in a very interesting way. What does he say? Well, I know he's not supposed to be Jewish, but he answers with a question. Let's see. What is the question? Could somebody read the question that he asked? Please, Nancy.
Does Job not have good reason to fear God?
Yeah, you have to ask it like a Jewish question. Does he not have good reason to fear God? Go on.
Why? Sorry. Why? It is you who have fenced him round. Him and his household and all that he has, you have blessed his efforts so that his possessions spread out in the land.
Go on.
But
lay your hand upon
all
that he has,
and he will surely bless
himself. Blaspheme you to your face. Now, what does the word blaspheme mean? It means to curse, to curse, which is a pretty vile thing to do to God, right? I think it's a vile thing to do to anybody, but to do it to God means you really are angry at God and you're rejecting God. So what is Satan saying here? What is the adversary saying? Yeah, he's saying, you know what, Job is just a superstitious pagan. He is being good to you because you've been good to him. He will not do that if you are not good to him. Now, this actually has two effects. One effect is to basically clarify that's not the right way to behave, right? It's not right just to be faithful to God just because God does good things to you. That's the implication. The other thing is it tempts God, or it pushes God to respond to this, because he dares God. It's the adversary who dares God, who pushes God here. Okay? And what's God's response? The Lord replied to the adversary. Would somebody like to read what the Lord says? Ethan, you're feeling divine today? Or please.
See, all that he has is in your power. Only do not lay a hand on him.
Right. Now, we've all seen movies like this where, you know, they can rough you up, they can take your possessions, but don't lay a hand on him. Why not? What's that all about? Why? Why a limitation?
Well, you don't want to leave a mark.
Okay. Don't want to leave a mark. But also, you know, he's responding to a dare. And so maybe the dare, you know, maybe you could say, all right, let's take away all these possessions and all these other things. But, you know, look, he's a good guy. So, after all, how does God treat people who are good? He treats them well. So I'm not going to just, like, let you do away with him. Okay. So the adversary departs. And now...
I mean, also, this yes. was about concrete things. He's got a lot of stuff.
Yes, he's got stuff.
And he never was raised up because he is such a healthy guy. Like that wasn't what was under discussion in the first place.
Right. In other words, what we're looking at here is all this stuff. And by the way, I think we would all agree that when we ask ourselves, what's, you know, what's most precious to us, we don't say our stuff. Our stuff is your health, of course. So we're going to get to that.
But the people in his life were also listed as his stuff.
Well, yes. This is a biblical story, after all. And, you know, our stuff includes, the work of our hands includes our children, as we'll see. But, okay, so what happens? So, I'm sorry?
So this notion of not laying a hand on him.
Yeah.
He does suffer physically.
Well, we will, yes, well, we'll see that later on. He really suffers.
Absolutely.
But there's something that happens in between.
Okay.
Let's bring this up. Verse 14. Do you need a text, Rose Jane?
I have a text.
Do you have it?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. You would. I apologize. I didn't hear you properly. Here.
I'm sorry about that.
Here. No problem. It's good to have you here.
Thank you.
Okay. So a messenger... There, by the way, the sons and daughters are eating and drinking. Are they just eating and drinking regular food? They're eating and drinking wine. Okay, so they're really, there's a suggestion here that they're indulging a little bit too much, or maybe not too much, they're indulging a little bit. And a messenger comes to Job and says, you know, the oxen were plowing and the she-asses were grazing when Sabaeans, this is a, you know, presumably a tribe, come along and attacked them and carried them out, and they put the boys to the sword. I alone have escaped to tell you. That's a common biblical trope, by the way. I alone am alive to tell you. Sort of like, do you believe this person or do you not believe this person? I mean, there seem to be a lot of them in the Bible. There seem to be a lot of situations where one person survives to tell the tale, okay? Anyway, this one was still speaking, so Job doesn't even have time to respond to this. When another one says, you know, God's fire fell from heaven, took hold of the sheep and the boys and burned them up. I alone have escaped to tell you. This one was still speaking when another one comes up and says, ah, a Chaldean formation of three columns made a raid on the camels and carried them off and put the boys to the sword. I alone have escaped to tell you. Oi. This one was still speaking when another one came and said, oh, your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in the house of their eldest brother, and suddenly a wild wind, a mighty wind came from the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, so it had collapsed upon the young people and they died. I alone have escaped to tell you. So, at this point, and by the way, it builds up, of course, and finally, what is he told? He's told that his kids have been buried in this terrible, terrible destruction from this mighty wind. And by the way, we'll come back to this. This will come back. The idea of a mighty wind will recur much, much later in the book of Job, but it's already introduced right here, the idea of a mighty wind. Okay? What does Job do? What do you do when these horrible things happen? By the way, what does the adversary think he will do? Remember, what does the adversary think he will do?
Curse God.
That's what he wants to do. Is that, by the way, is that the natural consequence, do you think, of all these terrible things happening? Or is that an unlikely thing? You know, it's a very interesting thing to ask yourself. How likely is it? In any event, before we even can answer the question, let's read what actually... Yes, I'm sorry, Gary?
But are these people people who were partying with those people? No, or are they an outside observant?
You mean the people who were killed?
No, people who are coming to say that I alone...
These kindly messengers. I think the implication is they were observers of what happened. That the implication is they are like empty characters. They are just communicating the message from one place to another.
Placeholders.
Okay, placeholders. So what does Job arise and do? And this is actually quite moving, and you should all know this verse. It's a very famous and important verse. We usually quote part of it, though not all of it, for obvious reasons, out of delicacy. Job arose, he tears his robe, he cuts his hair, he throws himself on the ground, and it says he worshipped in the English, but it's vayishtachu, he spread himself out prostrate on the ground. The implication being in prayer, but it's not explicit. Vayishtachavot in Hebrew means to lie down on the ground entirely straight. It's, by the way, the posture on Yom Kippur when we prostrate ourselves, and Muslims prostrate themselves in prayer. So it is a prayer posture, but it doesn't say in prayer in the Hebrew, okay? And then what does he say? By the way, what's the significance of tearing a robe? When someone dies, it's an act of mourning to make a tear. And that's a very, very common motif in the Bible. Whenever there's bad news, tearing the robe is a sign of that, okay? Cutting the hair is not... I wouldn't say cutting the hair. I would say shearing part of his hair. That was also a practice, a mourning practice that's no longer practiced, okay? Of leaving the hair wild. That was a sign of mourning, okay? It's the opposite of going to the hairdresser before the funeral. I mean, literally, this is the idea. You make your hair wild. He throws himself on the ground, and then what does he say? Naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. What does that mean? Why does he say that?
Like the basics, like you're starting at the basic level and you're going back. So all the things you have in the middle.
So in other words, all those things I just lost, they don't mean anything to me. That's not who I am. That is no way of cutting at my core. He then goes on to say, and this is what we quote, when we cut kriya, when we suffer a loss. This is what we read. We say, the Lord has given, the Lord has taken away, blessed be the name of the Lord. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Not only doesn't he not curse God, he blesses God. Okay? And, bechol zot, through all of this, I wouldn't translate it for all that. I would say, notwithstanding all that he had endured, Job neither sinned, nor did he cast reproach on God. Okay? So this did not have the effect that the adversary thought it would have. Okay? By the way, yes, David?
The Hebrew looks interesting here. I wonder if it's...
Yes, I know what you're thinking about casting a reproach on God.
Yeah, it's not exactly what it says in the Hebrew.
Word is not tefillah. It's tiflah.
Oh, okay.
It's the vocalization that's the key. The word for aspersion or reproach is tiflah, which sounds a lot like tefillah. Same letters. Fascinating. I think you're on to something, that there is a connection here. You know, it's like the difference between a prayer and the difference between blessing God and cursing God is just a little yud. It's just a little letter, right? Just like the difference between chametz and matzah is just a little space on the chet. You know, turning a hay into a chet. The letters of chametz and the letters of matzah are the same, except in one case you have a hay, in the other case you have a chet. So the notion is, maybe if he had pushed a little further, he would have gotten him to curse God.
You asked a moment ago, how likely was it that he was going to curse God? And I didn't answer out loud, but I was actually thinking it could really go either way.
Tell me why you say that. I agree with you. I just want to hear you articulate it, since I understand that we're thinking this.
I can't put a logic on it.
I'll suggest an answer, which is, if you're a faithful person and you live a faithful life, sometimes even things that happen in the world don't penetrate. they're not going to necessarily alter where you're at, because maybe he's not the kind of person that the adversary thinks he is. Namely, he's not someone who is worshiping God only because of the goodies that come his way, but he's actually worshiping out of a stance that he is comfortable with. Okay? All right. So we're being introduced, by the way, to Job as a more complex character than we might have thought. He's someone who, in the face of this terrible loss, says, Baruch Hashem. Right? Okay. Next. One day, the divine beings presented themselves before the Lord. The adversary came along to present himself before the Lord. The Lord says to the adversary, where have you been? Does this sound familiar? I mean, you know, it's sort of like, I'm thinking this is like, you know, somebody goes home to Bubby and Zadie. Oh, where have you been? It's like, what? We were just there. The adversary says, I've been roaming all over the earth. Oh, what a conversation. The God says to the adversary, have you noticed my servant Job? Wendy, please give us the quote.
There is no one like him on earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and shuns evil.
Yeah, and then she goes on, or he goes on. He still keeps his integrity. So you've incited me against him to destroy him for no reason. So then the adversary, you know, he wants to go a little deeper. He wants to flay the flesh a little bit. And what does he say? He says, skin for skin. All that a man has, he will give up for his life. Come on. But lay a hand on his bones and his flesh, and he'll surely blaspheme you to your face. Come on. Let me go deeper. So God says to the adversary, look, he's in your power. Only spare his life. So now it doesn't say don't touch him. He says only spare his life. Okay? All right. The adversary departs from the presence of God, and what does he inflict? A severe inflammation. This is, by the way, we're dealing in the era before cortisone, before antibiotics. We don't know how lucky we are, do we? We have pain relief. We have ways of alleviating suffering, which were not available to our ancestors. You know, when one of the 10 plagues is boils, you can believe it. It was not easy. So what does God do? What does the adversary do? He departs. He inflicts a severe inflammation on Job. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. That's an example of, I think it's called a merism, technically?
Yeah.
M-E-R-I-S-M, meaning from head to toe, meaning everywhere. So he's got itching everywhere. Could you shut the door a little bit? We're getting a little bit of distraction from the revelers who are not studying the heavy book of Job. That's okay. What was that? Yes, we will all be rereading the Megillah in a few weeks. So, he is miserable. How do you know he's miserable? Look at the next line. This is such a poignant line. He takes a potsherd, which is a piece of broken pot, to scratch himself as he sits in ashes. Now, why does he use the potsherd? He's so itchy. It's inflammation. It's making him feel a little bit better. But you know, it doesn't make you feel better. Maybe it temporarily feels a little bit better, but it feels awful. And what is he sitting in? Ashes. He's in mourning, basically. He is miserable. Now, at these moments, our spouses can really help. And, of course, Job realizes this, too. It's kind of like, I'm thinking of Haman and Zeresh, you know. It's the wife who always seems to know what to do. So what does she say to him in this time? Would somebody like to read what his wife says to, not to Haman, but what his wife says to Job? Please, Barry.
His wife said to him, you still keep your integrity. Blaspheme God and die.
Yeah, instead of just the exclamation point after the word integrity, I would put a question mark. You still keep your integrity, you jerk, you fool? You know, so she now becomes, in essence, a supportive, I'm sorry?
A proxy for the adversary.
A proxy for the adversary, or like a partner with the adversary. She becomes, like the adversary, a temptress. This evokes what story in the Bible?
Tamar.
Well, that's interesting.
No.
I want to go back even earlier.
Adam and Eve.
How about Adam and Eve, right? We've got Adam, who is being tempted both by the serpent and by his wife to eat that apple. Right? So there's a temptation to do what, in fact, he sees as improper. Okay, he's living in a #MeToo age. So what does he say? He says, "You talk as any shameless woman might talk." He dismisses her, okay, which is unfortunate that he uses this language, and we don't need to own it to study the book of Job. Should we accept only good from God and not accept evil? But he comes out with that line, which is a very profound line. Yeah?
That's an interesting understanding of evil. It's not good and bad, like not good and difficult. He's calling it evil.
Yes, I'm glad you raised that, because when I first studied the book of Job with Rabbi Gordon Tucker at the Jewish Theological Seminary many years ago, I was very puzzled by that use of that word, but apparently in certain philosophical discourse, you refer to a misfortune as an evil. So that word has a little plasticity to it.
I agree that yeah. that plasticity is there, but it's just it's interesting that, just like giving and taking good and
yes.
Evil.
But let me ask you a question: how do we understand suffering? Do we consider suffering to be an evil? Do we ever consider it to be good? Do we consider it to be neutral? You see, this is basically putting a moral valence on suffering. It's seeing suffering as an evil. What is that? Does that resonate with any of us?
Yeah.
Okay, how so?
It's awful to suffer.
It's awful. It's awful. It's miserable. Therefore, it's evil. There must be something wrong with this, and what it represents, and why it's coming upon.
Not as a distraction, but there are other schools of thought where there's this. The nuance of this would be pain.
Yes,
and
suffering. Very good. Well, I'm very, very grateful to you for bringing that up. One second. And indeed. In the pastoral care literature and in other discourse, what we learn is that someone can suffer pain and someone can also, or separately, can be suffering. Someone can feel pain and yet not be said to be suffering, whereas someone else...
Buddhists do that the best. The Buddhist mind does that.
I hear it. Well, I think we're going to come back to this. This is not going to disappear, this issue of the difference between pain and suffering. And the question, I would say that the way we've seen Job described, scraping his skin with this potsherd and sitting in ashes, I think that that's designed to evoke the notion of suffering and not just pain. But I think your point is very good, and I'm hoping that we'll come back to that. Yes.
But you're assuming that God can also be evil. That's
yes.
The way it sounds.
This is absolutely well.
Which is totally different than the normal perception of
yes.
God.
Well, we actually were exposed to this back in like verse 3 or something, weren't we? When in response to a dare, when in response to an adversary, God goes ahead and says, do whatever you want. Now, you could argue that that's not, it's not evil. That's pretty nasty.
It's not good.
It's not good. Yes?
Well, I mean, you have a theology that God is the source of good and some other power is the source of evil.
Yes.
Which, you know, the book of Isaiah explicitly rejects that.
Yes, it does. I think what David is pointing to is that we actually have a serious theological question, which is where does evil come from? Is it part of God? If so, then God is able to give out good and evil. Or is it from some other place, in which case God is not entirely powerful to vanquish it? I beg your pardon?
That can't be so.
It sounds like that's just impossible.
Yeah.
That doesn't seem Jewish.
No.
I would agree with you. I mean, and basically what David said is the same thing. Yotzer or vorei choshech, ose shalom vorei ra, is what Isaiah says, but the way it's read in our liturgy is God creates good and everything. It smooths over, because it does seem so offensive in later rabbinic thinking that God creates evil. I'm going to move away from this. This is a very important and profound theological conundrum. You know, sort of like I feel like saying, I'm going to give you a quiz. next week, who created evil? Where did it come from? What do we do with it? The problem of evil is a very serious problem. I think it's not the focus of this book is the problem of suffering. In my mind, not so much the theological question of where evil comes from, but you could say it's the same question because you said, where does suffering come from? If it comes from God, then that's equally problematic. I think we're going to see that the book of Job challenges our theology, challenges our understanding of God and how to understand God, how to think about God, how to feel about God. Okay, we're moving right along because I want to conclude this text, but we're almost there. So where are we? I'm sorry.
Verse 11.
I'm sorry. I'm in chapter 2? We already got down to that? Yes, of course. You talk as any shameless woman. He said nothing sinful. Okay. For all that, Job said nothing sinful. He said nothing sinful. Lo chata bisfatav. Meaning, he didn't curse God. All this time, he's still essentially loyal to God. Okay. And now we learn about him having three friends. It's not described in very much detail. We're going to see these three friends play extremely significant roles in the poem of Job. But here, they're just mentioned. When his three friends heard about all these calamities that had befallen him. And by the way, the word for calamities, hara'ah, the evil. Okay, so don't get too hung up on the fact that they're called calamities or that they're called evil. They're right. By the way, I apologize. I didn't get back to you.
No problem.
You okay? So you still want to make a comment?
The comment was completely ready.
Yes. Okay. When Job's three friends heard about all these calamities, all this awful stuff that had befallen him, each came from his house. We've got Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and so far the Naamathite. Okay. By the way, in ancient folk tales, you often have things come in threes. You know, it's actually very nice that walking down the street, they can take care of one another, can watch each other. You know, they'll make sure that nothing happens. Right? You got three of them, it's a good number. They met together to go and console and comfort him. Ah, so ask yourself the following question. What are they going to say to comfort him? What can they say? What will they say to comfort him? By the way, what do we mean to comfort him? What do we mean to comfort him in this particular case, up until now? Why does he need comforting?
Tremendous loss.
Which is?
His family.
What else?
His health, right?
He's miserable. Okay, so what do they mean, do you think, when they say console and comfort him? La nudlo ulenachamo, nechama. How can they? What will they do to console him? What could they do to console him? How do you console someone who's lost his family? How do you console someone who's miserable? What does it mean to console him?
You can't fix it.
You cannot fix it. No human being, these three guys in particular, as we'll see, they can't fix it. So what is in their mind that they're going to do?
Be there.
Okay, so you could say they want to be there. And, okay, let's see if that's what they do or if they do something else. Let's see. When they saw him, I think this is very moving, the sentence. When they saw him in Hebrew, they lifted up their eyes from a distance. Velo hikiruhu, and they couldn't recognize him. Why not? Well, it was because he's a. Was he grow a beard? Well, why can't they recognize him?
He's covered with sores.
He's
in the ashes.
He's sitting in ashes. He's looking. Sometimes when you visit someone whom you haven't seen for a while and who is gravely ill, they can actually look unrecognizable. So this captures a bit of that pathos, it seems to me. And what did they do? They broke into loud weeping. In the Hebrew, I have to translate the Hebrew, because this is quite beautiful. Vayisku kolam vayiku. They raised their voices and wept. In other words, they schreit Gewalt. They cried out in what? In sympathy, perhaps. Yes.
It's a blessing to him that they do this from afar.
Because it's preserving his dignity?
Yeah.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. That's very, very interesting. You know, there is a Jewish notion that under certain circumstances you should not visit a sick person face to face. And in particular, when he or she is suffering from certain maladies, such as intestinal distress. It's a very classic example. To preserve a person's dignity. You don't ever want that act of visiting someone to comfort the person to be at the expense of a person's dignity. And so, you know, that's a very nice example that David brought. So what did they do next? Each one tore his robe. Why? Why are they tearing the robes?
To commiserate.
Okay, so how does it commiserate to tear their robes?
That they're trying to show that they understand.
How do you show you understand? You tear your robe. It's a very powerful image because he had his own robe torn, right? So out of an act of empathy, they tear their own robes. Okay? And they threw dust into the air onto his head. That's a very interesting image. That may not translate too well today, but because I don't think we'd read it the same way. But in essence, they are empathizing with him because he's sitting in the ashes and they're putting more dirt on him. It's as if it's being... They know where he's at. I'm sorry?
Onto
their own heads. So they're basically doing the same thing that he did. They're putting dust on heads. Thank you for correcting that. Each threw it onto his head, meaning his own head. That makes more sense. They sat with him on the ground. Why are they sitting on the ground?
Because
he is. He's a mourner. What level is he on? He's on the ground. What level are they at? They're on the ground. They sat on the ground 7 days and seven nights. Does that sound familiar to you? The number seven? Okay. We use the term Shiv'ah because Shiv'ah or Shiva means seven. I do need to mention to you that in traditional Jewish law, Shiva never lasts for seven full days. Just so you know, it's never, ever, ever seven full days because there's a desire in Jewish traditional law to lighten the load. So the first day is always shorter than a full 24-hour day, and the last day is always shorter than a full 24-hour day. So it's always about five full days and a little bit before and a little bit after, just so you know. So the notion is you shouldn't over-mourn. Okay. That's actually very, very... So,
what about the Shabbat case?
Shabbat, there are no outward signs of mourning. You don't display mourning on the outside, but it counts as a day of mourning. So you could even argue that it's 4 days plus a little bit before and a little bit after, because every Shiva includes a Shabbat. Yeah. Okay? So there are no public displays of mourning on... You take off your torn garment on Shabbat. So you no one should see from looking at you that you're in mourning. And in fact, you're not supposed to behave as if you're in mourning. It's a very, very interesting rule. I'll mention one other example. You know, in shul, during Shiva, you shouldn't really have an aliyah to the Torah. But if you're asked, will you accept the fourth aliyah? You say yes, because you're not supposed to have any outward signs of mourning. So if someone, you know, asks you without knowing that you're a mourner, you say, absolutely, I'll do that fourth aliyah. Totally. I'm there. Okay, so that's actually, I'm glad you brought that up, because in fact, so every Shiva is never seven full days and nights. But in this case, first of all, he's not Jewish. We don't have this traditional rabbinic law. But also, there is this sense of seven certainly is a very, very profound element in the entire book of Job. This idea of seven full days and seven nights. Completion. Okay. Now, I'm sorry.
Is there something to the notion here that there's no words, there's only action?
Yes, of course. There are no words spoken. By the way, that is again something that is carried over in the traditional Jewish house of mourning. We're told you measure a eulogy, you measure the eulogy by the number of tears it generates. You measure, in other words, the quality of a eulogy is the amount of crying that it evokes. The quality of the Shiva house is measured by its silence. I hesitate to mention that to people who are having loud, noisy Shiva houses, but that happens to be the truth. That happens to be what it says in the Talmud. Because the notion is that in a Shiva house, you're not supposed to go in there and talk, you're supposed to go in there and listen. And presumably that's what these friends are doing, because they're not saying anything, right? And that's why this is a really effective first couple of chapters. Okay? Now let's jump to the very end of the book of Job. Okay? We still have a few moments. We have till 9:15. Let's just do the very, very ending, and then we'll explain what we're going to do next week. What we begin with, I gave you verses 7 and following, because these transition from those chapters 3 through 41. But really, let's start on the top of the last page with the third line. The point is, what we're told here is that Job prays on behalf of his friends. That's all that you need to know. Let's go to the second paragraph, verse 10. Okay? Verse 10. You see that? Mm-hmm. The Lord restored Job's fortunes when he prayed on behalf of his friends. So all we're told is that Job prays on behalf of his friends, which is a very nice thing to do. And the Lord restores Job's fortunes, and the Lord gave Job twice what he had before. Now, I hope you remembered how much he had before. Just think, he had a lot before, he's going to have twice as much now. And this is what David had alluded to. Things are even better. All his brothers and sisters and all his former friends came to him and had a meal with him in his house. They consoled and comforted him for all the misfortune that the Lord had brought upon him. Each gave him one casita and each one gold ring. I mean, it's very nice. They come to give him consolation and they drop off a little bit of jewelry. You know? Not such a terrible visit. Thus the Lord blessed the latter years of Job's life more than the former. He had 14,000 sheep, 6,000 camels, 1,000 yoke of oxen, and 1,000 she-asses. By the way, you can check the math. It's twice as ample, right? He also had 7 sons and 3 daughters. So these are not double, okay? But, still nice numbers, right? The first he named Jemima, as in Aunt Jemima, Yemima. The second, Kiziah, and the third, Keren Hapuch. Okay, the second one is really, okay. 3 names. We'll go into them later. Keren Hapuch. Nowhere in the land were women as beautiful as Job's daughters to be found. Their father gave them estates together with their brothers, because he had plenty, right? Afterward, Job lived, how long did he live? 140 years, which of course is twice 70, which is you'd consider to be a nice long amount of years to live. And he got to see 4 generations of sons and grandsons, so Job died old and contented. Thus endeth the fable of Job. Okay? We have this. This is an ancient story about Job. He suffered terribly. He is tempted to do what?
To curse God.
Does he curse God?
No.
And in, as it were, reward for this, what happens?
Twice restored.
End of story. Thank you. Okay. This is Job the pious. Job the patient. Job the perfect, you could say. Okay. This is not necessarily the Job of chapters 3 through 41. I say not necessarily because as you begin reading in chapter 3 and following, he's got the same name, he clearly was suffering, he's got 3 friends. But first of all, the friends don't behave the way they did in chapter 2. And he doesn't behave the way he began. He behaved in chapters 1 and 2. So, Cameron, yes?
Yeah, I just had a note. He's got double of everything except he has the same number.
Yes, the boys and girls. I'm not sure I understand that.
He doesn't get his original children back.
Unless, right, you know, it's possible that you could understand it in terms of the world to come, that it's still there for him in some strange way, but no, it's absolutely not described. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. He doesn't get double the number of children. I don't know what that's all about. I don't know. But what I do want to do is I want to read to you a tiny introduction to chapter 3 so that you'll see. Here it is. And you, so I just, this is a taste of next week. We are meeting next week, right? Okay. So you have a picture of Job. We've, right, the patient, the uncomplaining, the accepting, the Job who suffered terribly but recovered from his suffering. Sort of because he didn't complain, in a sense. You know, if we can push that. Okay. So let's see what happens as soon as we turn to chapter 3. And we don't have to read it now. I want to give you a flavor, a taste. Job spoke up and cursed his day, meaning his birthday, and raised his voice and said, "Blot out the day when I was born and the night on which they said, 'A male has been conceived.' Make that day dark. May no God look down after it from above. May no light flood it. Black take that night. May it not count in the days of the year. May it not come around in the rounds of the months." In other words, like, let's skip that day. The day I was born. Let's just forget about it. Like, oh, it's the day before my birthday, and now it's the day after my birthday. It's not on the calendar anymore. Curse it, men who spell the day. Men, may its morning stars stay dark. May it wait for light in vain. Why didn't I die inside the womb, or having left it, give up breath at once? Why did knees advance to greet me? By the way, when you were born onto the knees, okay, in the ancient days. Now I would be lying quietly. I'd be sleeping at rest in the earth. Why wasn't I like a stillborn, hidden like infants who never see the light? There the wicked cease their troubling and the weary are at rest. There the captives have repose and need not heed the foreman's voice. No, one thing I feared, and it befell me. No peace had I, nor calm, nor rest, but torment. That is not the Job, I would argue, of chapter 2. But it is the Job of chapter 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and so on and so forth. So, this is what I'd like to do for next time. We've studied the beginning and the end. We're going to study the middle. And we're going to, very quickly, at the beginning of next week's class, we'll talk about how it's structured, and we'll read some select passages. We can't read the whole thing. You can see how lengthy it is to read what we've read. And we were reading prose. If you're reading poetry, it's much, much denser. You may want, if you would like to, and you have the time, and you feel you can, read through chapters 3 through 41. Or even through 42 verse 6, you know, just so that you have the whole book. You're certainly welcome to do that. And that might be helpful to you. But I personally have always found it very difficult to read the book of Job straight through. It's not an easy book. Because it's in poetry and because it's so lofty, the language. But if you can, that would be great. And what we'll do next time is we will look at the interior of the book, moving ourselves up along, going through the arguments back and forth. And like I said, we may have we may take a little bit of time to have you discuss and critique the arguments in pairs or in triads. And then we'll probably get to the concluding response by God. And probably that we will have to wait until the next week. to study. Okay? Any questions? Okay, thank you all. I'm sorry, did you have a question? You want to come on up?
We didn't have any guess of what the name Job means.
I wondered about that myself. Let me...